many conversations have you started recently with, do you believe it's raining again? So have we had more rain, or does it just seem like it? Hi, I'm Jill Nadeau, sitting in for the vacationing Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network today. And it's time for the weather guys. But this month, we have only one of them. John Martin couldn't be with us, but Steve Ackerman is in the studio with me, and he's the director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies at UW-Madison, and a professor of atmospheric scientists. And we're going to talk about what the stats say about rainfall around the state. And as always, we'll be taking your weather questions. So give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. You can always join us on Facebook. Just look for the Larry Mueller Show and share your cool weather photos with us there. Well, hello, Steve. How are you?
I'm doing great.
Yes. You know, before we talked about rainfall, I'm always interested in finding out why people do the things they do. Hmm. Why did you start studying meteorology?
Well, that's a very interesting question.
Well, thank you.
And it has to go back to my undergraduate days. I had gone to school that was a teaching school in New York, in college.
New York?
In New York. Yeah. Very good. You notice that, right?
No.
I'm a Long Island boy, and I wanted to become a physics teacher.
Oh.
And then after being in that for a while, I realized I really didn't want to be a high school physics teacher. I wanted to, you know, do something differently. Mm-hmm. And then I realized I really liked research. But at the time, all the research in physics where you could get jobs and everything was in nuclear physics. And I just didn't like not being able to see what I was studying.
Yeah.
So a friend suggested I take a meteorology class. And I did that, and I realized, oh, this is applied physics.
It's
just applied physics. Mm-hmm. And so I went and got essentially a dual major in physics and in meteorology.
Okay, and you're teaching?
And now I'm teaching, right? Yeah. I don't think I ever lost that teaching bug. My dad was a sixth grade teacher, I think, which, you
it
know,
runs
kinda,
in the families.
Right, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then, yeah, eventually I became, got a research position here as a research scientist, and then doing that for 5 years, and then was able to join the faculty and do teaching.
Excellent. Time, yeah. It all kind of works out that way.
It all worked out rather nicely. It was almost like I planned it.
Yeah, I'm sure you did, right? Yeah. Okay, well, let's get back to this rain thing. Is it more rain?
It is for Madison. We've had like almost twice the normal, not quite, but 175% of normal. Yeah, we're above 6 inches of rain. As you said, it seems like it's been raining all the time. We've had, so that, you know, you can get a rain and an inch, quarter of inch, most of it's a tenth of an inch, but mm-hmm. you also have this thing we call a trace, which really not enough to get into the rain gauge, but it wets the ground.
Right.
And so if you count those types of rain events, we've had rain more than half the time this entire month.
Well, it sure seems
like 17 days of rain.
It's been kind of crazy.
And it's been kind of crazy. Yeah. I mean, you can see it in the lake levels around
River
Madison
levels
for sure. River levels. We've had some flooding to the east as well. Most of the state is above normal for July-type precipitation.
Now, you're talking about how many inches and whatnot. Who actually measures that? Where do we get that information from?
So there's two places we get it. We get it from the official sites, which are run by the National Weather Service. So they have.
And where do they get the information
from? They used to have they still have some observers in Sullivan and La Crosse and Green Bay. Mm-hmm. They also have automated stations, you know, that they calibrate, that measure rain. They have what's called a tipping gauge. And so it's kind of like a seesaw. It's really kind of interesting. And so when one bucket fills up, you know, maybe it's a small amount, a tenth of an inch or a 500th of an inch, when that bucket fills up, the seesaw goes down because of its weight, and it spills out. And then the other one starts to fill. By the time it seesaws back and forth, you can actually then add up and determine how much rain it occurs.
That would be interesting. Is there a cam involved with that we can watch one of these?
No, actually, we should put one in there, though.
It's
probably fascinating.
We were just talking about ant cams, so that makes total sense.
And then there's another way, too, where the public puts it in. So there's a community of rain measurement and snowfall measurements across the world. It's called CoCoRoS, Community cooperative for measuring rain and hail.
Sure.
Yeah.
That's exactly what that is.
Yeah. And that's fun to do.
Yeah, I'm sure. We're talking to Steve Ackerman. He's the director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies at UW-Madison and a professor of atmospheric scientists. We'd like to talk to you. What are your questions? Give us a call. Phones are open, 1-800-642-1234. Or you can always post on the Facebook page. And of course, we're looking for good weather photos there. I know we've got a lot more rain. It seems also to me that it's coming down in thunderstorms and big kind of torrential rain. We used to get more, you know, soft days where it was just a light rain all day, and we don't seem to be doing that. Or am I just have a faulty memory?
No, you have a pretty good memory.
Okay.
But when you have memories like that, it's always good to check it with data.
Yeah.
Because
sometimes
our memories, we tend to, particularly with weather, remember the big events.
Oh, yeah.
Right? The big snowfall events or the big heavy rain events. But there has been some work looking at the trends in heavy precipitation over the last 50, 80 years or so.
Oh.
And it is beginning to show a trend towards, even if you area in the Great Lakes regions in particular, that's one I'm the most familiar with, even if there are areas where the annual amount, the average amount hasn't changed much, it tends to be coming in shorter, fewer events, which means fewer events, same. They're going to come in heavier. So we're seeing that kind of
when they
trend.
Come down heavier, is that not as beneficial then for maybe crops and things? Is it runoff more?
Yeah, with crops, it's pretty critical in the timing of when you get it. I mean, you don't want to be getting those heavy rains when you're trying to plant seed.
Right.
And if you have too much dry spell, then the ground dries and it gets that crusty sense to it, and then it just runs off. And so, yeah, the type of rainfall you get is really important for agriculture and when you get it.
Right.
Yeah.
So is that kind of all into the whole climate change basket? Is that?
So we're thinking, although the direct connection to the trend in seeing heavier precipitation generally coming, that direct connection, the physical, I mean, so we're seeing the correlation, but not necessarily the causation of why would that occur?
Why would that occur?
That kind of forcing happen.
Yeah, well, that makes sense. Yeah. Well, we do have some phone calls waiting for us. Okay, well, should we go to Lee in Green Bay? I think we probably need to address this once in a while. Lee, what's your question?
Excuse me. Good morning. I would like Steve to comment on geoengineering, or what is known to some people as chemtrails, the spraying of some of the jets that takes place. I know Jill took a call last week from a gentleman when Larry had, looking for shows to have in the future, and there was a gentleman that wanted to know more about it. It got through. And I'd just like to know more about this and why there isn't more discussion.
Okay.
Because it's happening.
All right. Well, thank you. Thank you, Lee. Let's talk about it, Steve.
Yeah. So I'm going to separate that into his two questions.
Two questions,
is in terms of geoengineering, and then the other is chemtrails.
Right. Two different topics.
Chemtrails, it's not real. There are things called, they're called contrails. And so it's the jets that fly high. If the water vapor conditions up high are correct, then as that jet engine comes out, it's got a lot of moisture in those jet engines. If it's the right conditions, it'll mix with the air around it and form tiny droplets, very much like on a cold winter day when you breathe out.
Right.
Great analogy. And so I know that there's conspiracies out there that that's the U.S. government poisoning us, which is totally not true. I was actually involved in some experiments in the mid and early 90s where we actually flew into those things to actually measure them because we were very concerned more about the unintentional consequences on climate change, in terms
all
of
the extra moisture.
The moisture up there and then forming clouds and those clouds staying around. And so we actually penetrated those and looked at those and see what's in there. And they're water. And then you can see some of the features based on the type of gasoline that they were running, whether it was high sulfur or low sulfur. So that was another interesting part of it.
Yeah.
So the whole chemtrail thing is really, it's a conspiracy theory that really has been disproven a number of times. They are contrails. They are things that you see, but it's not the government poisoning us. And then the geoengineering is a really interesting question because people are starting to look at ways that we might offset global warming that we're observing that's being exacerbated by human activities. And so there was a whole National Academy study of looking at that, what to do, which is great. I think it's an important thing to look at to see if there are things that we might be able to do, although I personally tend to hedge on the cautionary side because, again, we're changing the climate not because we intended to. We unintentionally did that.
Sure.
And it's a very, the nature's a very complex. And I know my analogy is back in the 40s and the 50s in particular, and to some degree in the 60s, there was attempts to do rain modification, so to try and get clouds to precipitate. Mm-hmm. And there were a lot of experiments that were done on that.
Cloud seeding.
Cloud seeding, exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And again, we didn't really know the physics, so it's, again, there's no statistical evidence that it actually worked. But again, we were doing things that you don't really know what the unintentional consequences are. So with geoengineering, I think as the caller indicated, you know, from somebody calling in and saying it would be a good thing to do, I think that would be a good thing to hear what's on there, what's on people's mind, whether it's trying to change the atmosphere. Like I know one thing they people were talking about was to put a bunch of particles up in the stratosphere to reflect more solar energy out.
Right.
Which I think that's one of the ones where I would say I wouldn't do that.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
We don't know what the impact is.
Right.
But there are other things that could be mm-hmm. Done that maybe aren't as drastic.
Okay. Well, great. Well, thank you, Lee, for calling in. And we're discussing that particular topic. Let's go back to the phones. And June in Madison has a question. What's going on, June?
Well, on July 7th, very late in the night, really, it could have even been possibly early July 8th, I was awakened and I could see some lights out outside my window, and I thought at first it might be in an ambulance or a fire truck or something like that, and I thought, no, it's not really like that. And I got up and I looked, and there was nothing out there. I looked up into the sky, and I saw something that was so amazing to me I've never seen before. And I tried to explain it to people, and they just looked at me a little strangely. And
I get those looks too.
and I went online, and the closest I could come to what I saw was something called a crown flash. And I would say that nothing I saw on the web was nearly as dynamic as what I saw. And I'm wondering, it looked almost like a little volcano up there, you know, in the clouds. And I thought maybe their moonlight was such that it was positioned such so that it was a lighting up ice crystals in the cloud. Is that possible?
It is. So when you saw this crown, what was it, like a flash? So an on and off type thing?
I thought that's what it was. You know, something was going around. I mean, it was a little scary at first.
It's probably not the moonlight interacting with ice clouds then, because that wouldn't be so flashy. That would be a much slower time scale. It could be, I'm trying to think now what was going on in Madison around that early July, whether or not we had thunderstorms. There was lightning that's very unique that occurs above a thunderstorm. And so if there's a thunderstorm down to the horizon, off to the horizon, you might not even see it. You might see these other lightning flashes that are occurring way up above the cloud, up in the stratosphere, where the cloud isn't even going. And that would be amazing because not many people see what that is.
Okay,
get
well,
to see that. And I'll think a little bit more about that.
Well, you
just
think
looking
about
at me like,
that.
Let's go on.
We'll think about that a little bit. We've been talking about weather with Steve Ackerman. He is the director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies at UW-Madison and a professor of astropheric sciences. I'm Jill Nadeau. I'm filling in for Larry Mueller. Stay with us. More to come. Well, we're talking about weather today on the Ideas Network. Hi, this is Jill Nadeau. I'm sitting in for Larry Mueller. Thanks for listening. The weather guys stop by once a month, but today we only have one of the dynamic duo with us. Steve Ackerman is the director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies at UW-Madison and a professor of astropheric scientists. You guys try saying that three times really fast. The weather question. What weather questions do you have? Join the conversation. Our phone number is 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org, and you can post on the Facebook page. Our Facebook page is called The Larry Mueller Show, and we always like to see weather photos. And before we go to the phones, which are full at the moment, I want to talk to you about this. I think it was Peter called, but he couldn't stay on the phone, and he wanted to ask about a weather phenomenon that damaged his trees. He said that on the TV, a Rochester meteorologist cautioned about possibility of low-pressure easterly winds forming in backsides of some of the storms. And sure enough, the storm was wonderful, summertime storm with lots of lightning, lots of thunder, and his phone's radar showed it was almost throughout the area, no problems. And then, out of nowhere, on the backside, it turned vicious with up to 70 mile per hour winds that did damage to his trees. A large part of La Crosse and the surrounding area was hit hard with a lot of tree damage. And at the time, the wind switched from east to west, and it was as though it was a hurricane. And he'd like to know, what was this?
Yeah, that was a nasty storm.
Thank
I don't
you.
Think you need to be
that's
a meteorologist
a
to know that.
Opinion.
That's my professional opinion. The thing with some of these thunderstorms is that they can get so, the circulations and the storm itself can get so well organized that they actually develop their own circulation system embedded within an environment. And some of these big storms will develop what we call mesolows. So they're low systems that actually get formed within the thunderstorms. And low systems is air rushes from high pressure to low pressure. And so if that intensifies quickly, you can all of a sudden have a pressure force that generates really strong winds that get wrapped up into the storm. And it occurs on the backside of the storm, as he was indicating here. So it looks like the storm goes through. But yeah, the nasty winds are yet coming.
Yet to come. Yeah. Oh, that's kind of scary. All right, well, let's go back to the phones. Our first call here is from Pete in West Madison. West Madison, I haven't heard that said before. What's your question, Pete?
Hello. My son was asking me the other day, we were up in the North Shore of Minnesota, and the thunderstorms were going across from the northwest, across the lake, Superior, and the bottom of the clouds was like puffs, like little cotton ball puffs up there. And we've seen that before here, sometimes with tornado storms. And my son said, well, what causes that? And I said, I don't know. Biology in college, took one class, I loved it. An expert to tell us about that.
Yeah, I think so. They're puffy, but they're smooth. They're undulating sacks of cloud that they look like, right?
Yeah, they're not like waveforms.
Right, yep. They're called mammatus because they look like mammal glands that are just hanging out of the bottom of the storms.
Yeah. Okay.
And they're absolutely gorgeous to look at. Usually, well, I would say almost always they're associated with some kind of thunderstorm, although the thunderstorm doesn't have to be severe. You know, so you don't need a large hail or tornado or anything like that to get them. They're beautiful, particularly a lot of times you'll get them at sunsets, and so they'll be lit up from the sun down by the horizon. So they'll take on yellow and orange colors and things like that. They're also really interesting because most clouds form as air rises. Where, as far as we can tell, these sacks are actually cold air that's sinking and then condensing and forming the clouds. So they're kind of unique in how they look and how they form as well.
Okay, and we got some beautiful cloud pictures. Yeah, thanks for
actually,
that call,
actually, that's
Pete.
One of them right there.
Cheryl.
From Cheryl's.
Mm-hmm, yep. And she sent a beautiful one, and I'm going to share it on our page right now so that you can see it if you just go to The Larry Mueller Show. Yeah, there it goes. But it's beautiful, those little puffy.
Yeah, you'll see the little
clouds.
Sacks if you think of the little sacks that are just hanging out.
Yeah, almost look like little eggs up there. So that's pretty cool. All right, well, let's go to Ted and Toma. And Ted has been waiting for a little bit longer than normal. Hi, Ted. What's your question?
I'm used to it.
Well, thank you. We appreciate it.
Hey, I have a question on how do you calibrate rain gauges? Not that I'm going to do one, but there has to be a standard somewhere because I got a new one and it's right on, but I measured 5 inches on that. It says 7 inches with my tape measure.
Uh-huh.
And go to the store and look at rain gauges. They're all different shapes, all different sizes. There has to be some kind of a, you know, you have 3 or 4 pots and pans out there. Obviously, I think they're going to have different amounts of water in them, aren't they? I mean, there has to be some kind of a...
Yeah, there is a very... a reference instrument that you would compare to. And so, yeah, if you have a pot out there, it may not do it. I just go out and buy one because they are kind of a pain to calibrate. And to really calibrate one, you gotta have one anyway that works. And then you can collect some water, you know, pour it in and say, according to the reference, what does it say is an inch or a tenth of an inch? And then take that same amount of water and pour it into the rain gauge you're making and then put a mark on there that says this is 0.1 or 0.4 or whatever. Rain is a really tough measurement to make. If you have that nice steady rain, which we don't get much in the Midwest, Mass, you get it on the East Coast more, where it's just light rain that just falls straight down, that's kind of easy to measure because it's going to fall into that capturement, that the tube that's catching that rain. But if it's a windy day, you know, you can just imagine, how do you collect that? So those raindrops may not fall. They may hit the side and not get in. You may get some extra ones. You know, you may have a gust comes through that brings in a hard rainfall just for a moment or blows it off the trees. So the placement of a rain gauge is really tricky, as well as the calibration and the actual measurement itself. And snowfall is even harder because it's hard to capture that stuff because it just swirls around. It may not fall into the gauge that you're using.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, thanks for that call and for waiting, Ted. We appreciate that. You know, before we get back to the phones, we've been hearing so much about the total eclipse of the sun that's coming up on August 21st. And actually, we're doing a show on the topic on August 14th. So listeners, make a note of that. Is that going to have any effect on weather?
Probably not. What we call on the micro scale, so the small scale. So mm-hmm. if you're in the total eclipse area and you're out and it's cloud-free and it's sunny, you know, which is what you want.
Right.
When it becomes totality, it's going to be like all of a sudden jumping into the shade. And so you'll physically feel a temperature drop. But it's not going to cause any kind of precipitation or anything like that, any major wind changes. We'll probably see it in satellite imagery. I know we tracked one across the Sahara a number of years ago. And on the surface, you know, the sand gets hot pretty quick and then cools down pretty quick. And so if the totality lasts, I think a lot of these are going to last for like 2.5 minutes or so if you're right along
it's
the track.
It's pretty quick, yeah.
It's pretty quick. Mm-hmm. But it's enough that you'll actually, in the satellite imagery, see the surface start to cool down because you've taken away that solar energy gain.
Oh, pretty neat. All kinds of neat things associated with that. Like I said, we'll be talking about that August 14th. And let's go now to the phones. We've got Bob in Eau Claire. Hi, Bob. What's your question?
Hi, guys.
Hey,
I live in Eau Claire, and I've called in before, talked about this for kind of like anecdotal evidence of storms missing Eau Claire. They hit everywhere around us, but don't hit the actual city nearly as often. And this last month, I ran a kind of an experiment. And yes, I do have a degree in science. I've got several apps, weather apps on my iPhone. Mm-hmm. And so what I did was I watched and in fact documented by posting them on Facebook. I watched every storm of any significance that came through the Chippewa Valley. And I would say that of 12 potential rain events that could hit Eau Claire, only one actually produced significant moisture to measure. And that was the last one last week that came through on Wednesday. And we got 38 hundredths. And we have a Taylor gauge. In fact, I'm a member of the Coco Roz
group. All right, yeah.
Yeah, and so this Taylor gauge seems to be fairly accurate. We're never dead on between the airport, but we're 10 miles south of the airport, too. So I think that has something to do with it. And a lot of times the airport gets a lot of moisture where we never see a drop.
So Steve, is there a force field there?
No, Bob, I'm really glad you're doing this because we do have a number of people who will call up, whether it's Eau Claire or La Crosse, where it seems like, and even Madison, where the storms tend to split up. And a lot of it is impression, but I think what we need is somebody like you to go ahead and document what's going on there in order to get the statistics to see what goes on. I'm wondering now, I'm a Cocoras too, and we have a lot of people in Madison area, and I don't know how many people are up in Eau Claire, but it might be interesting if you can get a network, if there is a network up there, is to pull the data for each one of those sites, because I'm pretty sure it becomes public, we all agree to share it, and then look at those different sites over a longer time period, so you get more than 12 events, but...
Okay.
That's the way to do it,
yeah.
Is to collect the data on that. And it doesn't surprise me that you're different than your airport, because I'm only maybe 2 miles, 3 miles away from the airport in Madison, and I often have different amounts on the order of a tenth of a degree or not, particularly this time of year.
Okay. Well, thank you, Bob. That was a great question. And hopefully you can network together with some of your other science friends and come up with some more information for us.
But that's the way to do it, is to collect the data.
Yeah, definitely. Science is all about data. Let's go to Bill in Madison. Hi, Bill.
Hi.
I think we're having a little bit of a problem there. It's apparently yesterday he saw two satellite images, one European and one the United States, and they were so different. And how can that be?
Oh, that's a good question. Well, they're all good questions. They're all fun questions.
Yeah.
And it could be that the satellites are getting better and better as we launch them and, you know, move into new eras. So it's possible that he could have looked at two satellites that were, you know, 10, 20 years apart, because we still have satellites that are flying that are 10, 15
right.
years old.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is that some of the satellites measure different things. And so some, depending on what they're measuring, have very high spatial resolution because they may be interested in the surface types and actually seeing cornfields and things like that. And then other ones may just be interested in knowing whether or not there's a big weather system there. So the spatial resolutions of the two instruments could be very different, and that might be what he was looking at.
Okay, so basically getting a little more information about the satellites.
Yeah, right, yeah, the satellites, what the names of the instruments are in particular.
All right, well, sorry again we couldn't get that call through, but we got that question answered. Let's go to Kenneth in Janesville. Hi, Kenneth. What's your question today?
Hello. It seems that this summer the humidity levels have been higher than average, yet the temperatures are not, the humidity would be coming from the south, from the Gulf, but the temperatures don't seem to be that high except for a few days in early summer.
Yeah, that's actually the way it's been in July, and I think that's very similar in June. I'm not quite remembering June as much, but in July, our temperature for almost all of southern Wisconsin was at average. So it was our 30-year normal. But, you know, you're right. We had a lot of precipitation. I mean, it's rained almost every day. Every other day, essentially.
Yeah.
And so the air is moister. So the humidity is up. And most of the time, this time of year, we get a lot of our humidity coming up from the Gulf Stream. So that's a good hypothesis.
Yeah. Well, great. Yeah. Thank you, Kenneth. Appreciate the call. Let's go to Corey in Garden, Michigan, right on the shores of Big Beatty Knock. Right, Corey?
Right.
Are you surprised I knew that?
Yeah, actually.
I don't know what that is.
I grew up on the shores of Big Beatty Knock, so that's why I knew. I was surprised to get this. Corey, what's your question?
Well, it's more of a information, not a question. It's more of a kind of a question to see if you're even familiar with it, because I'm not sure if it's even a real thing. A government program called HARP that changes the jet stream in order to steer storms and change climate. Does that ring any bells, or is that just a total conspiracy theory thing that I picked up on the internet?
It's a conspiracy theory thing. Although there is a HAARP, and I'm pretty sure they recently closed it down. I don't know how recent. It was, and it sent energy radiometric waves into the upper atmosphere in order to do communications with submarines and that kind of thing, very low frequency. I'm pretty sure it was in Alaska. Is that right?
Yeah, that sounds right. It was up north. Yeah,
and I'm pretty sure they closed it down, and that the University of Alaska has is in the process of opening it up to do other types of studies or to use that land, because apparently it was a big area of land that they were using. And I remember it was a colleague of mine was telling me about it and showing me pictures. They're trying to, you know, get the funds to get the line, to get it back up, to do some research in the upper atmosphere with it.
Okay. Well, Corey, thanks for that. Does weather have a lot of conspiracy theories? Because we seem to be
We have ones that just won't go away.
Yeah.
The chemtrails is one. Uh-huh. Of course, the fact that global warming isn't occurring is the most serious one, because that's the one that it's clear. Well, they both have very clear evidence that the government is not trying to poison us. And by physics, by observations, by theory, by modeling, we are impacting and changing the temperature of the globe. So to be ignoring that is much of a concern to people.
To scientists in particular. Sure. And you're looking at statistics.
We're looking at statistics. We're looking at numbers. And it's not just to see the statistics, but then to be able to physically explain what could cause that. And when we've known for a very long time that carbon dioxide is going to be transparent to solar energy and absorb long-wave energy, so we've known that for centuries, and now the modeling tends to show that, and everything kind of, it all fits together in a nice piece of the puzzle where it's clear. There's a couple of puzzle pieces missing, but not enough to say we don't know what's going on. We now know what that picture is. We know what it looks like, and there's just a couple of missing pieces we need to fit in.
Okay, great. Thanks for that question, Corey. We appreciate that. Let's go to Bill in Madison. Hi, Bill.
Okay, yeah, so I got cut off earlier. The thing that I was talking about, about the European thing, was I was watching yesterday on one of the weather channels. They had a European forecast for the upper Midwest and a U.S. forecast for the upper Midwest. In the European forecast, Minneapolis, St. Paul was getting 6 inches of rain. In the U.S. forecast, they were getting 1 inch of rain.
Do you remember how out? Because there is big differences when you go out 3 or 4 days between...
Oh, this was yesterday for Thursday.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, well, okay, but do the Europeans essentially have better satellites, different satellites?
They have... actually, the satellites that we run and the Europeans run for weather are pretty similar. You know, we just launched a new one back in November. It hasn't quite come online yet for operational applications, but that's, you know, kind of caught up to what the Europeans had 5 years ago. So now we're a little better than them, and they're going to be launching one in 3 years, and they'll be better than us. I think with regard to the forecasting, what we've seen statistically is that in general, the European model does better, but on any individual day, it might not. So I don't know if Minneapolis got that 6 inches of rain. That seems like a lot of rain.
I think we would have heard about that.
Yeah,
interesting. Okay, well, Bill, I'm glad you got back through. Appreciate you calling us back and explaining exactly what you wanted to ask us. You know, talking about satellites, you had mentioned to me that there's some new equipment that's going up on satellites for lightning detection.
Yeah, so that's kind of the, again, you know, where we caught up now and surpassed the Europeans and everybody else.
Although we're quickly, because it's a competition.
It's a competition. You know, it's a pride thing, but we're about to fall behind on some other things that they're going to launch. But one of the things that we have up that's going to be released pretty soon, or at least you're going to be able to see it on some of our web pages in particular, is a global lightning mapper, it's called, although it's looking at the U.S. and the hemisphere. And so this is the first time we're going to have this type of instrument in geostationary orbit. So instead of just getting a snapshot of a thunderstorm, we'll be able to monitor how much lightning flashes are occurring within that storm as it goes through its life cycle. So
that's pretty neat.
It's pretty exciting. There is indications that the flash rate and whether or not there's breaks in the flash of a storm is connected to tornado development and other severe weather.
Oh.
You know, so now we'll have the complete data to actually start exploring some of those relationships and hopefully being able to improve tornado forecasts when they occur and give people a little bit more lead time to prepare for that.
Well, that's amazing because you've been doing such a good job of preparing people in case there's tornadoes. I mean, it's been improved so much in the last few years. Yeah. You know, I was looking on the website and we do have all these beautiful pictures from Cheryl and she takes some great cloud pictures. Aren't they gorgeous? Just out of curiosity, I know I saw some really neat clouds yesterday I was wondering about. They were like, you know, kind of flat penny shaped almost ones. But I was thinking, where would I go to find out what those were? I mean, is there an app for that? Is there a great research place?
You know, I'm going to bet that there's an app for that.
Okay.
But I'm not totally sure. But if you do a Google search on NOAA Cloud Atlas.
Okay.
Or just Cloud Atlas and then ignore if a book comes up.
That's right. We talked about that. It was a great book.
There'll be charts that'll tell you the different types of clouds and what they look like. Give you an example photograph.
Okay. Well, that's a good place to start. I will definitely have to do that. Well, it's been fun, as usual, talk with you. Actually, I think this is the first time I got to talk with you guys.
I think it is, definitely.
Well, that's lucky you.
Yes, I'm very happy. And there you go, John. This is what you get for missing.
Well, thanks again, Steve. Steve is the director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies at UW-Madison and a professor at Atmospheric Scientist, almost this time. Thanks to Michelle Johnson, our executive producer and on-air producer this week, and to Dave Potras for technical direction. Tomorrow at this time, we're going to be looking at UW Health's program that uses mindfulness to help ease stress in teachers. That's at 11:45 tomorrow. Hope you can join us for that. I'm Jill Nadeau, and I've been sitting in for Larry Mueller while he takes a well-deserved vacation. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network. Stay with us. There's much more to come.